to talk to you for a few minutes this evening about a thought that Randy put in my head a couple of weeks ago when we were doing the radio program. And he said, tonight, Mike, we're going to talk about somebody who doesn't quite go far enough. They almost get there. They try to serve God, but they stop just a little bit short. A lot of times we talk about people who go beyond the Word of God. That's always a risk, and we really put a lot of emphasis on the ability, staying within the bounds of what God says, but sometimes people stop a little bit short. And he had brought up the idea of the rich young ruler. We know the story of the young man who came to Jesus and talked about all the good things that he had done, and he seemed like a very genuine man, seemed like a man that wanted to serve God and wanted to enjoy, you know, salvation, the life that comes with that, but he was faulting one thing, and Jesus knew it, that was that the problem this young man had was kind of like what was the problem of riches. He was a wealthy young man. He really loved his riches. And when Jesus said, you're going to have to take that out of your heart if you're going to put me there. And the young man went away sorrowful because he loved his riches more than he loved God. So he stopped short. He was almost there. Not that he would ever be good enough, but he was a good man, and he was really trying to serve God, but that was an idol that was in his heart. So I want us to think about that this evening just a little bit. I'm going to take it from use predominantly the Old Testament to illustrate the challenge that comes with what I'm going to call removing the high places. Maybe you're already on to where this is going, but you'll just have to wait and go with me anyway on this. In the Old Testament, David was the first really good king of Israel, excellent king, wonderful man after God's own heart. But his son, Solomon, while he was a wise man for a while, he wasn't the man that his father was. He entertained many foreign women and foreign wives. And as a consequence of that, God took away a large part of that kingdom after Solomon died, and he divided it up, and Israel became two kingdoms, the kingdom of the north, which they continued to call Israel, and had Jeroboam as its first king, and had 10 tribes, and then the southern part of Israel, which was called Judah, and it had 2 tribes, and Rehoboam was the king there. And what I want to mention to you is that for 350 years following the rule of Solomon, Judah was involved in a battle for its life against idolatry. And even today, it's very hard to keep idols from getting into your heart and allowing them to live there and having the honesty of heart to see when that idolatry is there, when there's an idol in your heart. There were some kings, there were some kings in the Old Testament who really dedicated themselves to ridding Judah of this problem of idolatry. They were great spiritual reformers. We might call them spiritual reformers. And I want to talk to you about some of those kings in just a minute. But for us to understand these reforms that they made, we need to go back and look at the law that God had put in place to begin with. So let's begin with going back to the Old Testament, to the book of Exodus. And what we're going to talk about is seeking to do all the will of God. Not part of it, but all of it. And the problem in this particular lesson is going to be where we see the high places were not removed. Maybe you already know about that. Let's look back here to the book of Exodus and see some things that God did not authorize the children of Israel to participate in. His people were to be different than the nations around them. So looking in your Bibles, the book of Exodus, chapter 20 and verse 3, where he begins by saying, as a prohibition, you shall have no other gods before me. They were not allowed to have multiple gods. We're not going to be polytheistic. The second thing he said to them that was prohibited is he said that they wouldn't be able to use images or objects to worship. He said in verse 4, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God. So they could not have images that represented objects of worship. Then they were not able to have something called columns. Look in Leviticus chapter 26, images and columns. I ordered some little CDs that have lots of pictures of all kind of things in the Holy Land or the land of Palestine, and so one day I'll learn how to use those discs, and I'll be able to illustrate maybe what some of these things were in those days. But they just were sitting here waiting to be opened when I got here, and I haven't learned how to use them yet. So anyway, look at Leviticus 26, verse 1. He says, "You shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God." You see these prohibitions that God is putting upon his people that's going to distinguish them from the nations around them. Then look at Deuteronomy chapter 16. Deuteronomy chapter 16. He continued when he to emphasize these prohibitions when he sent when Moses gave this was the second giving of the law as he was preparing Israel, this generation of Israel, to enter into the land of Canaan. So chapter 16, he says, look in verse 21 and 22, the end there, he says, "You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. You shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar which the Lord your God hates." So here they are prohibited from putting up these pillars or planting an Asherah, maybe kind of tree, beside the altar of the Lord. So you can't have the Lord and have another God together. Some people like to worship the Lord, but they also want to have another in conjunction with it. That way we can cover all their bases. And then, earlier in that chapter, let's look back to chapter 16, verse 2. I'm going to read a few verses here. And I want you to listen to this carefully. He says in verse 2, "You shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name." Verse 5 and 6, he says, "You are not allowed to sacrifice the Passover in any of your towns which the Lord your God is giving you, but at the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name, you shall sacrifice the Passover in the evening at sunset at the time that you came out of Egypt." Verse 11, "And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, and your male and your female servants, and the Levite who is in your town, and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your midst, in the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name." And then in verse 15, he says, "7 days you shall celebrate a feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all that you produce, in all your produce, and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful." And verse 16, finally, "Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the feast of the unleavened bread, and the feast of the weeks, and at the feast of booths, and they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed." So here, God has limited the place where they can offer their sacrifices. They can't just choose at their own volition. They had to worship God where he said to. And I want you to look back to chapter 12 to understand why he designated a place. Look back to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Stay with me now. This is kind of, sometimes people wonder what value Deuteronomy is to us. But God was laying down the law for the way for his people. When they went into the land of promise, there were going to be some conditions upon which he would bless them. And part of that involved the place where they worshiped. And there's a reason for that. There was a reason that God chose that. Let's look in chapter 12, and I'm going to read a little bit here, verses 1 through 14. So I want everybody to focus and stay with me all the way through it. "These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which the Lord, your God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live on the earth. And you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. And you shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their Asherim with fire. And you shall cut down the engraved images of their gods and obliterate their name from that place. And you shall not act like this toward the Lord your God. But you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling. And there you shall come. There you shall bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices and your tithes and contribution of your hand, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. There you also and your household shall eat before the Lord your God. Rejoice in all your undertakings in which the Lord your God has blessed you. And you shall not do at all what we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. For you have not as yet come to the resting place and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. When you cross the Jordan, live in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies around you so that you live in security, then it shall come about that the place in which the Lord your God will choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and the contribution of your hand and all your choice votive offerings which you will vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and daughters, and your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion or inheritance with you. Be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every cultic place you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offering, and there you shall do all that I command you. So God decided the place for worship, and he prohibited other places. And he devoted a lot of space to this, didn't he? We read a good bit here. And there, you know, when somebody devotes that much space to in the law, even if he'd put one verse, that was adequate. But he really devoted a lot of territory to emphasizing that he would make that place, and that was where they were to worship. And that evidently continued all the way up to Jesus and the time of his death. You might remember when Jesus was having the discussion with the woman at the well, and I'm just going to read this real quickly, in John 4, and she said to Jesus, "Sir, I perceive you're a prophet." In verse 20, she said, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." Even in that day, they understood there was the right place and the wrong place that the law instructed people to worship. And so that reflects that. So here's Moses in Deuteronomy, and he's preparing people to enter the land. And he dies. These are his final discourses in Deuteronomy. The end of Deuteronomy, Moses dies, and he anoints Joshua as the next leader of Israel, and he leads them into Canaan, and their first order of business when they come into the land is to destroy the inhabitants and destroy all of the places of worship in that land. But those practices that God prohibited became common in Judah. In time, people forgot God's law, and they were not corrected, and even some of the kings began to lead the people into idolatry. I'm going to give you an example of that. Look in 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings chapter 14. The first king in the southern part of Israel, in Judah, was Rehoboam, and part of one of the things that Rehoboam did was he created a way for people to worship God in a way that God had not authorized. Let's look in chapter 14, verse 23 and 24. It says, Rehoboam misleads Judah. It says in let's just read 23 and 24 for the sake of this study. "For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars, and Asherim on every high hill, and beneath every luxuriant tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. And this was in the reign of Rehoboam. So even just one generation after Solomon, they had completely abandoned the instructions that Moses had given and were already worshiping in these high places. And so everything God prohibited, they practiced. And for 300 years after that, it got so bad that eventually God took the nation of Judah and he permitted the Babylonians to come in and destroy them and carry them away captive. And they stayed for 70 years, primarily because they worshipped other idols. Well, now I want to show you something that happened during the period of time of this 300 years. There were some kings who saw the falls, saw the idolatry, and they did it. They did their dead level best to eradicate that idolatry. And I want to visit six kings who tried to improve things during this period of time. So if you'd look in your Bible with me, 1 Kings chapter 15, I just want you to visit six kings who tried to do better. First of all, Asa. 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 11 through 14. Let's read about Asa. It said, Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. And he put away the male cult prostitutes from the land, and he removed all the idols which his fathers had made, and he removed Micah, his mother, from being queen mother, because she had made a hard image as an Asherah. And Asa cut down her hard image and burned it at the brook Kidron. This is a good man. He even punished his mother. This was a man who really tried to make things better. Verse 14, but the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. Interesting, isn't it? Here's a man who did things, many things right, and he was wholly devoted to the Lord, but he didn't remove the high places. Look over another passage to 1 Kings 22 to see another king named Jehoshaphat. Chapter 22, verse 43. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he became king, and he reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. I want you to notice that these men are very young. I want you to notice these kings are men who are in the age range of a lot of men here. They're kings. And he said in verse 43, he walked in all the way of Asa, his father. And he did not turn aside from it, doing right in the sight of the Lord. He was a good man, followed in the footsteps of his father. However, verse 43, the high places were not taken away, and the people sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Let's look at another king, Joash, chapter 2 Kings now, 2 book of Kings, chapter 12, verse 1, 2, and 3. Chapter 12, verse 1, 2, and 3. In the seventh year of Jehoash became king, and he reigned for 40 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Jehoash did right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which the priest instructed him. Only the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And look at another example. 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 3 and 4. Now we move to the name of another king that you may know by Uzziah, but here he's called Amaziah. Chapter 15, verse 3 and 4. Let's start verse 2. He was 16 years old when he became king. And he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jecoliah of Jerusalem. And he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Only, what? You can almost quote it now. The high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. And then one other example. A man named Jotham in chapter 15, at the end of that chapter. And Jotham was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. In verse 34 says, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, and he did according to all that his father Uzziah had done, only the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense in the high places, and he built an upper gate, the house of the Lord. And this was a man named Jotham. And so you have five generations here of kings. And again, we see this repetition. They were good men. Some of them were devoted to the Lord. And they made significant changes. They were reformers in Israel. They saw the problems. And they tried to reform, but they all stopped short. There's one black mark against their names. And that way they did not remove the high places. So what I call this is an incomplete reform. As much as they did, they stopped short of what they should have done. Now, I want to give you two more examples of some men who did better. There are two kings who did better than these. And I want us to read about them very quickly. Look in chapter 18 of 2 Kings. This was the man Hezekiah. And he did his work. He reigned during Isaiah's prophetic life, when Isaiah was prophesying. And he was a good king. And he was a good leader. He had courage and he had faith. And he did even better than his predecessors. Look in chapter 18, verse 3. He was 25 when he became king. And he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. And he removed the high places. Verse 4. And he broke down the sacred pillars. And he cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days the sons of Israel burned incense to it. And it was called Nehushtan. And he trusted the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those who were before him. For he clung to the Lord, and he did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments which the Lord had commanded Moses. Here's a man who's a good man. He was not too unlike the other kings that came before him that did great reforms. But he went even further. He went beyond the other men. And because of his dedication, he was remembered as a great king in Israel. There was none like him before him. What a wonderful legacy to leave behind. Now, ironically, his son was a disaster. He was the absolute antithesis of his father. Look in chapter 21. Just read, his son's name was Manasseh, and he undid everything his father did and went beyond the wickedness of the other kings. Verse 2 and 3, Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominations of the nations, whom the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel, for he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed. And he erected altars for Baal, and made an Asherah, as Ahab the king of Israel had done, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven, and served them. That's a strange thing to figure out. Hezekiah was a good man, a diligent man, a good leader, but his son didn't follow his footsteps. And he tried to undo, and he was able to undo, everything his father did in his reign. But we have one other good man to look at, and his name was Josiah. And in chapter 23, Josiah was the grandson of Manasseh and the great-grandson of Hezekiah. And we read about him in verse 8. You might remember Josiah because he's the one that found the book in the temple. And things must have been pretty bad in Israel or Judah when you lose the book of God's law in the temple and you can't find it. And he discovers the book, the priests do, and they bring it to him. And it says in verse 8, here are some of the reforms that he made. Verse 8 of chapter 23. He brought all the priests from the cities of Judah, and he defiled the high places, or he profaned the high places where the priests had burned incense from Geba to Beersheba, and he broke down the high places of the gates which were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on one's left at the city gate. Verse 13, and the high places which were before Jerusalem, which were on the right of the Mount of Destruction, which Solomon the king of Israel had built for the Ashtoreth and the abomination of the Sidonians, for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Milcom, the abomination of the sons of Ammon, the king defiled. Usually when we think of somebody who's profaned or defiled something, we think of somebody who's taken something that has been set apart by God and defiles it. But in this case, this was something that was an abomination to God, but had been made sacred and holy, and this king is defiling this thing and destroying what had become holy in Israel that God had not ordained. Then look at verse 14. He broke in pieces the sacred pillars and cut down the Asherim and filled their places with human bones. Verse 19. Josiah also removed all the houses of the high places which were in the cities of Samaria, which the kings of Israel had made, provoking the Lord. And he did to them just as he had done in Bethel. And all the priests of the high places who were there, he slaughtered them on the altars, burned human bones on them, and then returned to Jerusalem. And then verse 24 and 25, moreover, Josiah removed the mediums and the spiritualists and the teraphim and the idols and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem, that he might confirm the words of the law, which were written in the book that Hilkiah the priest found in the house of the Lord. And before him there was no king like him, who turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul, with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. Wow, so here is a man who went the extra mile. And two men. And they destroyed all of the high places completely. Two kings were seen as excellent because they made reforms beyond what the others did. So what can we learn from this? This is what's the lessons that we can learn? Well, you might get the impression when you see how many years God tolerated this idolatry, and tolerated the sins, that really he wasn't too offended by it. You might get the impression that he was able to deal with this kind of thing, and 300 years he didn't do anything, it must not be too bad. But clearly God did not approve of what he allowed to be practiced. And these stories of these kings are there for a reason, to show us his disapproval. And in the end, he destroyed Judah because of this. In fact, the very next verse says in verse 26, however, the Lord, even though all that this king Josiah did, it says, however, the Lord did not turn away the fierceness of his great wrath with which his anger burned against Judah, because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. And he said, I will remove Judah also from my sight as I have removed Israel. And I will cast off Jerusalem, this city which I have chosen, and the temple of which I said, my name shall be there. Because they profaned the place where he put his name, and they abandoned him. He ended up sending them away into captivity for 70 years. And so, just because God doesn't act immediately and make an immediate judgment when people begin to profane his ways, and does not mean that he approves of it, and does not mean that he is somehow going to just let that pass over and not pay any attention to what we're doing. Some people will say, well, we live in the age of grace, and we're not in the Old Testament. And so we're not too great a risk if we keep a few high places. But Paul dealt with that, I think, when he said in Romans chapter 6, what shall we say? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? Because God is graciously saving us in his mercy through Jesus Christ, does that mean somehow he's going to be tolerant of our sin? He said, may it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live in it? Grace is not permissive. In fact, it appears in the New Testament that there is even more severity if we neglect the grace that God has shown to us. You remember that Acts chapter 17 and verse 30, God said that there were times of ignorance. Chapter 17 and verse 30, He says, "Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent." Seems like He's not giving us these overlooking anything. He is charging us to change our lives completely. Or maybe we ought to read in Hebrews chapter 10. Let's read Hebrews chapter 10. Verse 26 and beyond. "If we go on sinning willfully, after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of a fire which will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much severer punishment do you think he will deserve who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' and again the Lord will judge his people. It's a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God." We shouldn't do anything outside of the authority of God. He says this grace is not a license, but it is a blessing that we have, and we shouldn't abuse that. So the question, practical question to me, and I guess there's supposed to be another thing here, and I forgot to show you, what high places have we not removed in our lives? What things are in your life? You know, it's common to imitate the example of the kings who made reforms. We do, you know, when we're baptized, a lot of times there's a lot of radical things that we change in our lives. We know, we're immediately confronted in the beginning with a lot of things that we're doing that's really out of line with God's law. And we make some very radical changes. But in time, is it not true that we become kind of more comfortable because we've got our lives in order and we've eliminated so many things that were out of line that we then become kind of comfortable and we leave some of those high places and we don't remove them? Do you know there were probably 19 kings in Judah altogether, and 8 of them tried to reform it and only 2 of them were successful? Do we have the courage of the 2? Or are we more sometimes like the 8 or like the other 6 who tried but they left the high places and did not complete the process? What about, you know, what courage, do you have the courage to become a Christian? That's a practical question. Are you almost there? Are you doing most of what is necessary to become a Christian? Do you have almost everything? Do you look just like a Christian in your character and the way you're serving, but have you not been baptized? We talked about that this morning. Well, maybe, I don't know why, what the reason is, but maybe that's a high place. There's something that's, you haven't gone far enough, you haven't gone all the way that's necessary to have fellowship with God. You know, we have the courage sometimes to remove 95% of the things that we need to remove in our lives. But there's sometimes there's just that one thing that we won't give up. It just is something I'm not going to negotiate on. And that's, I think, the way Brother Earnhardt put it. He said, that's where you are. That's who you are. It is that point where you're saying, I am not giving that up. I'm not denying myself that. And that's a very hard thing. Because I know that there, if I, you know, and that's where we have to look honestly at ourselves and say, what is that high place where I'm just not interested in compromising? It's tempting in the life of a congregation, a church, to begin to look at ourselves through rose-colored glasses and say, "Wow, look at, you know, we are just so different, and we're not like some of these other churches, and we got something special here." And we begin to see ourselves, and that may be very true. It may be a really good group in a sense. But we can certainly deceive ourselves into thinking that we have no high places that we need to remove and some places that we need to correct so that we will be like a New Testament church. So we need to look and see, where are the high places that we need to make changes on? Do we have the courage to imitate Hezekiah and imitate Josiah, to abandon everything, to remove all the high places in our lives? And so tonight's kind of an invitation. You know, God is able to help us. And this is very hard, very difficult, to remove that one thing that we do not want to deny ourselves. but He will give us the power to do it if we learn, if we love Him more than we love ourselves. That rich young ruler went away, and he was sad. And Jesus was sad because he had a high place, and he was not willing to remove that. Don't go away tonight and not make some determinations and make some changes or make some decisions. I am going to identify that, and I'm going to pray, and I'm going to work with all my heart with God to eradicate that place that doesn't belong in my life. I encourage you to do that, to make those commitments tonight as together we stand as we sing.